Issues that we deal with today, the economic issues, the social issues, the racial issues, the environmental issues, not only impact your lives, they impact the lives of future generations, and you do not have the moral right to turn your back on saving this planet and saving future generations.
President Maduro was elected by a majority of the people in Venezuela. He stands for working and poor people. I'm a union representative who's retired now. I'm with Workers' World Party. And a lot of people in the U.S. do not agree with the U.S. policy of basically overturning or basically fomenting a coup in Venezuela.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum, and on today's show, a tale of sorts of two speeches and two very divergent worldviews. Yesterday, in a surreal scene at the White House, Donald Trump announced that he would withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. We'll talk to Scott Edwards of Food and Water Watch about what Trump's announcement means and does not mean. The other speech this week was by Senator Bernie Sanders before the graduating class at Brooklyn College in New York City. It's obvious that Sanders has read science, history, and understands something about the humanities. And in the second half, we'll hear his message to the class of 2017. All that is coming up, but first, our headlines from D.C. this week. In defiance of science, history, fellow war leaders, and some of his aides, President Trump announced that he would withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. That was an historic, if flawed, attempt at reducing carbon emissions globally. Scientists say that if steps are not taken immediately to curb climate change, the Earth will be increasingly uninhabitable for humans in just a few generations. Trump framed his decision in themes he repeated on the campaign trail as one that is good for American jobs and business.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries, leaving American workers, who I love, and taxpayers to absorb the cost in terms of lost jobs, lower wages, shuttered factories, and vastly diminished economic production.
Economic and climate experts dispute claims about the impact of the Paris Agreement, saying that this destructive impact of climate change is hurting all economies, fueling social unrest and poor health outcomes. More on Trump's Paris exit speech later in the show. Other actions in D.C. this week highlighted the connection between the U.S. and climate change. The burgeoning Capital Region has developed some of the worst traffic in the country, while its Metro Mass Transit system, which could ease traffic and air pollution, is suffering from a lack of federal funding, mismanagement, and lapses in safety. Employees of Metro are fighting for safer working conditions and for their jobs. Lydia Curtis attended a meeting of Metro's board on May 25th and filed this report.
About 100 people representing workers and passengers crammed into the WMATA office to present their concerns to the board. WMATA, better known as Metro, or the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, is in crisis. If left as is, there will be 1,000 layoffs this year and 1,000 layoffs in 2018. The general manager, Paul Wiedefeld, has proposed a compromise that includes service cuts, reduced pensions, and privatization to save the beleaguered system. But the Amalgamated Transit Workers, Local 689, D.C. Area Churches, IAF, the Industrial Areas Foundation, which includes Win and Build from Baltimore, said no in a loud voice.
I'm David Stephen, and I'm the communications coordinator for ACU Local 689. Right now, what we are experiencing is something that's unprecedented in the 41-year history of WMATA. The degree of disrespect that the management and leadership of WMATA has shown to its workforce is unprecedented. And that's what brought us here today, was that you have management that is blatantly telling their workforce to shortcut when it comes to safety, to not follow procedure, and when they do that, then they are met with intimidation, threatened with discipline, and that's unacceptable.
The meeting was very, very short. It was convened at a little bit after 10, maybe 10:01, and by 10:50, it was adjourned. It seems as if the board doesn't allow itself enough time to properly run a system as large and complicated as Metro. This is Lydia Curtis in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Lydia. And still more actions in D.C. this week highlighted the connection between the U.S. and the global community. Protesters showed up at the Organization of American States in Northwest D.C. to demand that the organization head, Luis Almagro, stop its effort on the behalf of the United States to topple the democratically elected government and people of Venezuela, which have been subjected to a series of violent right-wing attacks in recent weeks. Carlos Ron, minister counselor for Venezuela here in D.C., told Pacifica Radio this week that public documents from the State Department revealed that the OAS is a U.S. puppet.
It's interesting to take a look on the congressional budget justification for 2018 that was just released 2 days ago, and the description that the State Department makes of the Organization of American States, I'll quote literally, says the Organization of American States promotes U.S. political and economic interests in the Western Hemisphere by countering the influence of anti-U.S. countries such as Venezuela. I mean, that's literally there, and then when you see that, you're gonna wonder. And this is a public document that was presented to Congress. You know, it's not a WikiLeaks article. I mean, it's very open. And you already see what the disposition is. And so the Organization of American States has, especially under the leadership of Luis Almagro, they basically have ruined any possibility of even playing a constructive role in Venezuela.
The legislated coup in Brazil last year, which saw the removal of the democratically elected President Dilma Rousseff, was also the subject of a demonstration in D.C. on Thursday. Chantel James has more.
Thursday evening, a crowd gathered outside the Brazilian embassy in Northwest D.C. to voice their demands that Michel Temer, the president who succeeded Dilma Rousseff in what has often been called a soft coup last year, be removed from office. Brazilian expats for democracy came together with Code Pink and other local social justice organizations to make it known that they would not be moved until true democracy comes to Brazil. Brazil currently has the world's highest rates of homicide, as well as the highest rates of violence against LGBTQ people. Brazilians and friends of Brazil alike beat homemade drums and raised their voices in song as speakers came up one by one to speak to the crowd in an open mic format. One of the group, who due to fears for her safety wished only to be identified as a member of Brazilian Expats for Democracy, illuminated parallels between Brazil's situation and the current American climate at a time when solidarity is needed more than ever.
So we're here to call out all of these things, to defend landless workers, to defend land defenders, to defend democracy, and you know, show them that we are not going away without a fight. And you know, Temer said he's refusing to resign. And he said if we want to get him out, that we're going to need to force him out. And so we're here to do just that in solidarity with our people in Brazil, and you know, trying to get Brazil's message out in the United States and in other countries around the world.
From Embassy Row, this is Chantal James.
Thank you, Chantal. Well, with me to further illuminate national and international headlines this week, our geopolitical analyst, historian, and prolific author Gerald Horn is on the line. Well, Gerald, let's start with this proliferation in hate crimes. Trump began yesterday's Paris exit speech with an acknowledgement of breaking news about a terror attack abroad. This one, what he called a terror attack anyway, in the Philippines. But critics pointed out his delayed response to attacks by white supremacists against people of color in this country, including 1 week ago an attack in Portland, Oregon. And in that case, Jeremy Christian fatally stabbed two men and seriously wounded another after they stopped him from harassing a Muslim woman on a light rail train. And, of course, that follows the murder of an African-American student right here on the University of Maryland campus. So what are your thoughts?
Well, Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton is no doubt correct when she noted yesterday that the election of President Donald J. Trump has unleashed, quote, an incredibly dangerous, unquote, level of hate. It's not only the incidents that you cite, the killing in College Park, the killings in Portland, Oregon, but also right there in Washington, D.C., you might recall that just this week, two nooses, symbols of hate, were found at the National African American History and Culture Museum right there in the district. You might recall that just a few days ago, Cleveland Cavaliers basketball star LeBron James found racial epithets scrawled on his home in West Los Angeles. But perhaps even more concerning is that just recently, the New York Times published a long piece seeking to humanize Dylann Roof. You recall that Dylann Roof was the assassin, the murderer, who killed nine black people in a church in Charleston, South Carolina. This is an incredibly dangerous turn of events, as Secretary of State Clinton noted.
You know, there was also the situation where the Princeton professor has basically canceled the rest of her speaking engagements because when she criticized Trump in a recent commencement address, she received a barrage of death threats and people making claims against her and her family. And so she's canceled all her speaking engagements. So this is another way that this type of hate is kind of impacting people that is not lethal, but is extremely dangerous.
Well, I think we should also observe that when one door closes, another one opens. You mentioned quite correctly the negative reaction in the international community to President Trump removing the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. And those of us who study history recognize that when there has been a formidable attack against U.S. levels of hate, such as the attack on slavery, that was driven in no small part by the Haitian Revolution and the general crisis of the slave system it helped to inaugurate. The attack on Jim Crow was driven in no small measure by the rise of Africa, that is to say, the decolonization movement in Africa. Right now, as former President Mary Robinson of Ireland calls the United States a rogue state, and when there has been an almost universal negative reaction to the United States in the international community, there is an opportunity for our forces domestically to make a dedicated and direct push in the international community that could help to reduce the spectacular levels of hate that we are now enduring.
There's also kind of this feedback loop in terms of these types of attacks on people of color internationally in Venezuela, in Colombia, and it seems that these attacks here in this country are having an impact or kind of emboldening people in this hemisphere.
I think that your point is well taken. I should also mention there's a connection between President Trump's speech in the Rose Garden yesterday and what Africa is enduring. That is to say that climate change is leading to the spread of deserts, particularly the Sahara Desert, which in turn is driving people across the Mediterranean Sea into Europe, which is then helping to unleash a high level of attack and hatred against those people of African descent, which imminently and obviously has impact on people of African descent right here in North America.
Well, since we're already across the Atlantic, the other thing that happened this week, which was kind of eclipsed by this speech yesterday by Trump, is the kind of soured rhetoric and relations between the U.S. and Germany. And so it seems like this isn't just a spat. It seems like a pretty bad breakup.
I think that we may be undergoing a dramatic and paradigmatic shift in the international correlation of forces. That is to say that the post-1945 transatlantic alliance may be breaking up. And once again, this opens opportunity for our domestic movement. Recall that it was less than a century ago that the government in Germany was actually paying black Americans to sabotage the United States economy as the United States was about to enter World War I. Historically, if you look at the anti-slavery movement, you'll find the Germans played an outsized role in that particular movement. The only problem is right now is that our movement has lost the ability to think globally, which helps to explain why we're in the pickle we're now in.
Continue to follow these stories. And Gerald, you are also part of the final headlines segment on culture and media today. Starting on Monday, the publication Black Perspectives and the African American Intellectual History Society will be hosting an online roundtable about your work. And it's titled Gerald Horn's Black Radical History. So every day for 6 days, a different scholar will post a significant post about your work, and the public can comment and engage in discussion. And joining us to discuss the roundtable is Charisse Burton-Stelly, Assistant Professor of Africana Studies and Political Science at Carleton College in Illinois, and she'll be one of the presenters. Welcome to On the Ground, Professor Burton-Stelly.
Hi.
Yeah, thank you for joining us to talk about Gerald, Professor Gerald Horn. And, you know, he has this, like, really big title and formal title. And, you know, he's a regular contributor to our show, so we don't say that he's the Rebecca J. Moore's Professor of History and African-American Culture at the University of Houston. But, you know, I know that in the world of scholarly pursuits, this is an author of more than 36 books. So I wanted to start with your views on the place that Gerald's work holds in the world of scholarship and academia, and talk about this whole week devoted to him online next week.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Gerald Horn is, like, without a doubt, one of the most prolific scholars of the 20th and 21st century. He's written dozens of books, articles, book chapters, etc. And you really can't study black radicalism in a systematic way in the academy without engaging with his work. And he's really at the forefront of scholarship on the intersections of the Black Scare and the Red Scare. In other words, the ways in which United States history, foreign and domestic policy, and social relations more broadly are fundamentally predicated on the subjection of black people and on the repression of radical organizations and insurgency. And so, in his very extensive canon, I think that he's developed this thesis from a number of angles and in many different ways. So I think that his work gives us a sense of the effects of what he calls the 250-year counter-revolution in the United States, and the effect of that on black people, on third world people, on radicals, anti-imperialists, internationalists, and on states, organizations, and individuals that seek to fundamentally challenge the system of racial capital. I think that what's unique about his canon is its breadth and depth. Generally speaking, scholars have either breadth or depth, but not both. Mm-hmm. And so his analysis traverses virtually every continent. And so you get a sense, on the one hand, of the international network of solidarity that has been forged against U.S. imperialism, coloniality, and white supremacy. And then on the other hand, you get a sense of the sheer reach, pervasiveness, and tenacity of white domination. I think a final thought on his scholarship and its relevance in the academy is that even when he's profiling, like, a single individual like Paul Robeson or Shelley Graham Du Bois or Ferdinand Smith, you get a sense of the connectedness of all of these struggles for liberation, whether he's talking about slave uprisings or anti-colonial movements, petitions to the UN, a revolution for independence, and on and on and on. You really get a sense of the relationship and of kind of the role of people in challenging these structures. And so you really get a sense that it's people, especially those committed to justice and freedom, that drive history. It's not about individuals or about saviors. So I think that, those are kind of two fundamental fundamental contributions that he's made to scholarship in the academy.
Okay, so how can people connect with this online roundtable? How can listeners go and read the different posts about Gerald and the different analysis of his work next week?
Okay, yeah. So the roundtable is called Gerald Horn's Black Radical History, and it'll take place from June 5th through the 10th. And it features posts by myself along with four other amazing scholars who are prolific in their own right. And Gerald Horn will respond to our posts on the last day, which is next Saturday. And we will we'll cover his scholarship on slavery, Caribbean history, Trans-Pacific Black history, the boys, and my own interest on his biographical work. So you can get a hold of this roundtable, access this roundtable at the African American Intellectual History Society website, which is aaihs.org. Once you get to that page, there's a tab that says roundtables, and if you click on that, you'll be able to access it. And then if you subscribe to the blog, the entries will be sent directly to your inbox each day. Mm-hmm. And also the AAIHS will be posting on social media, so on Twitter and Facebook. So there will be lots of information there. So you should follow them at AAIHS on Twitter.
Okay. Just say that website just one more time slowly.
Yes, AAIHS.org.
Okay, great. Well, I've been speaking with Charisse Burden-Stelly, Assistant Professor of Africana Studies and Political Science at Carleton College in Illinois, who will be, again, one of the presenters for the online roundtable, Gerald Horn's Black Radical History, that begins on Monday, and everyone can go to the website to connect with that online event. Thank you for joining me, Professor.
Okay, thank you for having me.
And thank you, Gerald, for joining me as well again today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, Trump withdraws from the Paris Climate Agreement. Stay with us.
Thank you.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum, and surely the biggest story out of D.C. this week is the announcement by Donald Trump that he is withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. Joining me now to talk about what Trump's announcement means and does not mean is Scott Edwards, co-director of Climate and Energy Policy for Food and Water Watch. Welcome to On the Ground, Scott.
Thanks, Esther. Good morning.
Well, I've seen several reactions to Trump's speech, including one headline calling it a screed devoid of facts. So let's start with first, with your reaction to Trump's announcement.
Yeah, this was certainly not unanticipated, right? I mean, he campaigned that he was going to pull us out of the Paris Climate Agreement, so not unexpected. You know, I have a lot of reactions to it, a lot of mixed reactions. You know, in some sense, the pulling out of Paris has more of a symbolic impact than an actual on-the-ground climate impact.
Right.
And that's because Donald Trump has already put into place, with or without Paris, many of the truly devastating, harmful climate policies that he was going to enact anyways.
Right.
And quite frankly, Paris, Donald Trump and the United States will be in Paris even if Donald Trump manages to make it through his first term as president. We can't actually pull out of Paris until November of 2020 under the terms of the agreement. So ironically, the next presidential election, which is on November 3rd, 2020, happens a day before we can actually technically leave the Paris Accord, which
wow.
is on November 4th, 2020. So this was, I think, you know, a big message to the rest of the world, as Donald Trump has been doing since he's taken office, that he doesn't care what they think. He doesn't care what anybody thinks. He only cares about Donald Trump and what's good for Donald Trump. And this was just a message. And honestly, I heard some commentators speaking last night about how this decision may have simply been, I mean, he was on the fence. Reportedly, about this may have been precipitated by his anger at the Macron handshake, and the fact that this was an accord that took place in Paris, is something as petty as that may have influenced this man.
Wow, we are in real trouble in the world. Right?
Yes, we are.
So, you know, even though this, you know, statement is, you know, roundly denounced, and this act is roundly denounced, you know, many environmental activists are saying that, you know, local governments can still overcome many of the, much of his hostility to science by pushing for renewable energy and other reforms at the local level. I know I had Winona Howder of Food and Water Watch on the show a couple weeks ago, and she was basically talking about your new campaign, Fossil Free, which basically is empowering people at the local level to make these kinds of changes that would counter what Trump is doing.
That's right. We recently launched the Off campaign, Off Fossil Fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And much of what we need to do, and we needed to do this anyways, and we've been doing it as a nation, as a community of concerned activists, we need to force a transition to renewable energy. And that transition certainly can be facilitated at the federal level and good executive branch policymaking and good congressional actions, and we certainly are going to continue to fight to get those things done. But really a lot of this fight has to take place right on the ground in communities where new power plants are being proposed, where fracking infrastructure pipelines are being put in place, where there's local decision-making, local permitting, local influence. And so we need to stop fossil fuel build-out on the ground in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, of course, continue to fight Trump and his administration. But the battle really has to take place on the ground in local communities. And that's what, and at the state level. I mean, you heard the mayor of Pittsburgh, just rejecting Donald Trump, yesterday and saying Pittsburgh is going to fight for renewable energy. And we're seeing cities and states across the country that will continue this fight. And that's the good news. Maryland banned fracking. New York's banned fracking. We have states and cities after city in this country adopting renewable energy plans. And so just as Trump has abandoned the international climate arena, we have states and cities in this country abandoning Trump's climate approach.
I've been speaking with Scott Edwards of Food and Water Watch. Thank you, Scott, for joining me.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Sorry, I thought I lost the connection for a minute.
No, it's all good. Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Now, when we come back, what Bernie Sanders had to say to the class of 2017. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, and I know, that these are tough times for our country. But I do want to say that standing up here and looking out at the beautiful people in front of me, I have enormous confidence in the future of our country. Let me begin by congratulating the graduating class of 2017. Today is an important day in your lives, something that I know you have worked very hard to achieve. And I want to wish all of you the very best of luck in your future endeavors. May I not be strangled? All right, I'll tell you what. That's it. See, not only do I think you have a right to read on the grass, I think speakers have a right not to have that stuff around their throats. But I do want, on behalf of my wife, Jane, and myself, to see and to pray that you all live healthy and happy lives, doing the work that you enjoy, surrounded in love by family and friends. And let me thank President Michelle Anderson, Nicole Haas, the Brooklyn College administration, faculty and staff, and all of you for inviting Jane and me back to Brooklyn, where we were both born and raised. And I am very honored by the honorary degree you have given me. I grew up in Flatbush. And like Senator Schumer, graduated from James Madison High School. My wife, Jane, was also raised in Flatbush and Bedford-Stuyvesant and graduated from St. Xavier's High School a few miles away from here. In 1959, as a first-generation student, college student, I attended Brooklyn College for a year. A year which had a major impact on my life. After that year, I left for the University of Chicago, where I eventually graduated. My mom had died the previous year, and I felt it was time to leave the neighborhood and see what the rest of the world looked like. My childhood in Brooklyn was shaped by two profound realities. First, my mom, dad, and older brother, who graduated from Brooklyn College, lived in a 3.5-room rent-controlled apartment. As with many of your families who don't have a lot of money, financial pressure caused friction and tension within our household. From those experiences of growing up without a lot of money, I have never forgotten that there are millions of people throughout this country who struggle to put food on the table, pay the electric bill, try to save for their kids' education or for retirement. People who, against great odds, are fighting today to live in dignity. The second reality that impacted my life was that my father left Poland at the age of 17 from a community which was not only very poor, but from a country where anti-Semitism, pogroms, and attacks on Jews were not uncommon. While my father emigrated to the United States and escaped Hitler and the Holocaust, many in his family did not. For them, racism, right-wing extremism, and ultra-nationalism were not political issues. They were issues of life and death, and some of them died horrific deaths. From that experience, what was indelibly stamped on my mind was the understanding
that we must never allow demagogues to divide us up by race, by religion, by national origin, by gender, or sexual orientation. Black and white, Latino, Asian American, Native American, Christian, Jew, Muslim, and every religion, straight or gay, male or female, we must stand together. This country belongs to all of us. As the United States Senator from Vermont, let me give you a very brief overview of some of the serious crises we currently face, crises which do not often get the attention they deserve, just are not talked about. As a student at James Madison High School many years ago, I recall my social studies teacher talking about how there were small developing countries around the world that were oligarchic societies, places where the economic and political life of the nation were controlled by a handful of very wealthy people. It never occurred to me as a kid in Brooklyn that the United States of America, our great nation, could move in that direction, but that is precisely, in my view, what is happening today. Today in America, the top 0.1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. 20 Americans now own as much wealth as the bottom half of America, and one family now owns as much wealth as the bottom 42% of our people. In the last 17 years, while the middle class continues to decline, we have seen a tenfold increase in the number of billionaires. Today in America, CEOs are earning almost 300 times what the average worker makes. And in terms of income, while you and your parents are working in some cases two or three jobs, 52% of all new income generated today goes to the top 1%. Meanwhile, at the same time as we have more income and wealth inequality than any other nation, 43 million Americans live in poverty. Half of older workers have nothing in the bank as they approach retirement. And in some inner cities and rural communities, youth unemployment is 20, 30, 40%. Unbelievably, in our country today, as a result of hopelessness and despair, we are seeing a decline in life expectancy. People are giving up, and they're turning to drugs, to alcohol, and even to suicide. And because of poverty and racism, today, in a broken criminal justice system, we have more people in jail than any other country on earth. And those people are disproportionately Black, Latino, and Native Americans. Directly related to the oligarchic community that we currently have is a corrupt political system which is undermining American democracy, and it's important we talk about that and understand that. As a result of the disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision, corporations and billionaires are able to spend unlimited sums of money on elections, and the result is today that a handful, a small number of billionaires are spending hundreds of millions of dollars every single year, often on ugly 30-second TV ads, helping to elect candidates who represent the wealthy and the powerful. And we are seeing the results of how oligarchy functions right now in Congress, where the Republican leadership wants to throw 23 million Americans off of health insurance, cut Medicaid by over $800 billion, defund Planned Parenthood, cut food stamps and other nutrition programs by over $200 billion, cut Head Start and after-school programs, and by the way, make drastic cuts in Pell Grants and other programs that help working-class kids be able to go to college. And unbelievably, at exactly the same time as they are throwing people off of health care, making it harder for kids to go to college, they have the chutzpah to provide $300 billion in tax breaks to the top 1%. In other words, the very, very rich are getting richer, and they get tax breaks. The working class and the middle class are struggling, and they are seeing drastic cuts, life and death, in life and death programs that could mean survival or not survival for those families. Now, in response to these very serious crises, it seems to me that we have two choices. First, we can throw up our hands in despair. We can say the system is rigged. I am not going to get involved. And that is understandable. But it is wrong. Because the issues that we deal with today, the economic issues, the social issues, the racial issues, the environmental issues, not only impact your lives, they impact the lives of future generations, and you do not have the moral right to turn your back on saving this planet and saving future generations. The truth is that the only rational choice we have, the only real response we can make, is to stand up and fight back, reclaim American democracy, and create a government that works for all of us, not just the 1%. And for us to do that, it is necessary that we fight for a vision of a new America, an America based on progressive, humane values, not the values of the oligarchy. And what does that mean, briefly in concrete terms? It means that, no, we are not going to throw 23 million Americans off the health care they have. We are going to bring about health care for all as a right, not a privilege. It means that, no, we are not, as the current administration does, deny the reality of climate change. No, we are going to take on the fossil fuel industry, transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. It means, no, we're not going to cut Pell Grants and other student assistance. We are going to do what Germany, what Scandinavia, what countries all over the world do, and that is to make certain that public colleges and universities are tuition-free. And we're going to significantly lower student debt, because we believe that anyone in America who has the ability and the desire should be able to get a higher education regardless of his or her income. And no, we're not going to do as the Attorney General of the United States now wants. We're not going to put more people in jail. We're going to fix a broken criminal justice system and invest in education and jobs for our young people, not more jails or incarceration. No, we're not going to defund Planned Parenthood. We're going to vigorously defend a woman's right to choose. My friends, let me conclude by saying this. We live in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. We are seeing an exploding technology which, if used well, has extraordinary potential to improve life. We are an intelligent and hardworking people. If we are prepared to stand together, if we take on greed and selfishness, if we refuse to allow demagogues to divide us up, there is no end to what the great people of our nation can accomplish. So today, as you graduate Brooklyn College, my message to you is very simple. Think big, not small, and help us create the nation that we all know we can become. Thank you all very much.
Wow. You were just listening to U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont delivering the commencement address this week at Brooklyn College. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum, and that will do it for today's show. Thanks to Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, and our engineer today, Katia Stitt. The music we played all during our breaks is from McCoy Tyner's 1962 album, Inception. The cuts we played, Inception and Effendi. We love to hear from you. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows and volunteer to work on the show. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. There's a green picket sign that says On the Ground, and that's how you know you're at the right place. I'm Esther Ivarum. I'll be giving an artist talk at the close of my exhibit at the Den inside the Anacostia Arts Center this Sunday, June 4th from 1 to 5 p.m., 1231 Good Hope Road in Southeast D.C. Hope to see you there. Keep raising your voice. Peace.
say another thing? I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you one of these days.